Welcome back, Raw Thoughts, to another episode with me, Mackenzie Tiggs. Today, I have a guest from Ada County Paramedics talking with us about her suicide journey, how she has overcame that, and where she is today. So thank you, Cameo, for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. I'm super excited to just hear this entire conversation, but I really want to start with, you know, kind of your experience of getting into the field, how you did that, kind of your experience. I know there's a story around your dad and sharing that.
There is. So I never wanted to work in EMS. It wasn't my goal. I was actually going to college up at U of I, and I was doing pre-medicine. So I wasn't really sure what route I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to do medicine. So I actually happened to be home down here in Boise. And my dad is a retired Boise City police officer. And so I really wanted an opportunity to get to spend some time with him. I'm the oldest of five, and I hadn't really had a lot of opportunity throughout the years to really have just one-on-one time with him. So I thought, what else, you know, but get in his police car with him and go for a ride along. He's stuck with me in a car.
Yeah.
We can have all kinds of conversations. So the ironic part about it is it was September 20th of 1997, which was the night that Mark Stahl was killed. So I happened to be right there in the middle of it, you know, watched three officers get shot, obviously one fatally, and then, you know, watched my dad shoot the two suspects, and was right there in the middle to see all of it, hear all of it, feel all of it. And so after that, I immediately decided I was going to become a paramedic. It was just like instantly. I never got back in a police car, which is, you know, ironic. I tried one time, I think, and I was just like paralyzed. I was like, let me out of this car. But for some reason, I think that an ambulance is armored and I will follow those cops in wherever they go in an ambulance. And so that really totally different direction that my life ended up going. And so from there, I just jumped in, you know, full force and just became an EMT and then became an advanced EMT right away, and then did a few years of that, got on the reserves, then got hired full time. I did some time out in CUNA as a volunteer while I was waiting, which was so much fun. I met some of the most amazing people. It was when it was still a volunteer department. And so that's how I started in EMS. It was not what I expected, and really a traumatic way to get involved in EMS. But I don't, you know, where it's taken my life has been pretty amazing. Lots of up and downs, but
yeah,
it's been amazing.
Yeah. How old were you when you were on that ride along?
I was 22.
22.
Yeah.
And you, what were those feelings when you were right in the middle of that?
You know, it's funny because earlier in the night, my dad was like, you can't hear or see anything if you don't get out of the car, right? Because I was a little timid to get out of the car. And it was just a routine, you know, stop. But I think everybody was slow. It was a slow night, so there was a lot of officers around. But it obviously turned very quickly. And we happened to be the car that was right behind their car. And Mark was just to the right of me, not very far. And so I remember being at the headlight of the car. And all of a sudden, you know, the tone was getting different. I could hear my dad giving commands to, you know, them. And all of a sudden, as I looked around, I could tell the officers had drawn their guns and had them down at their legs. And I was just like, I don't know where to go or what to do. You know, like in the movies, bullets don't go through doors. Not, I mean, then, you know, I just didn't know what to do. And once the shooting started, I got right behind the car door. It was open. I didn't get back in the car. I hid behind the car door. And then I just remember seeing Mark get hit. I couldn't see my dad anymore. He had moved up behind their car door, which I didn't know initially. And then I could see the other officer's legs. You couldn't tell really what was going on. And it happened so fast, but it seemed like it took forever. Mm-hmm. And then I remember, you know, I could hear the sirens and I could hear my dad yelling for people to stop shooting. And then all of a sudden it was just, you know, everybody was there and there was a lot of movement and a lot of things going on. I remember when I saw Mark get shot, though, I was trying to decide, and I was a bystander. I knew nothing about medicine. Right. But I was like, do I run over there to him? You know, but I could, there were shells around my feet and I was scared to move. So I just kind of stayed where I was and watched him get drugged back behind, you know, by another officer behind a pickup. And then everything from there, I got taken off the scene and we got taken to a hotel where we stayed until we were interviewed. And then it just kind of progressed from there. But yeah, that it was pretty wild.
You wanted some one-on-one time with your dad. You got some one-on-one time with your dad.
I did.
How did they, being 22, being on a ride-along, did they debrief you? Did they talk about what had happened or what you had seen? Because at that point, you didn't know you wanted to be a medic. You didn't know you wanted to be drawn to that.
Yeah, and it's interesting you ask that question because as a bystander, now I know as a first responder, you know, the way we debrief a lot is to go over and over and over the calls, right? We try to break them down. What could have done better? What happened? You know, and so officers do the same thing, especially when it's something that big. And so they would bring me to some of the debriefings, but it got to the point where for me as a bystander, reliving that constantly wasn't helping me.
Right.
And so I just kind of quit going to, you know, their debriefings and talking about it. Still to this day, if I hear the tape, I don't like it. I usually will leave a room if they're going to play that tape. And sometimes they'll play it in new hire academies and stuff, but you know, just it brings you right back to where you were. But honestly, it took me 16 years to get help for the shooting because I thought, you know, I just forget about it. I'm going to go on with my life. I'm going to start this new career and it's not going to affect me.
Right. Right. And the reality is that now you're going into a career where you are seeing more traumatic things.
Yeah.
So you ended college.
Yeah, I didn't finish college. I quit then and I went into, it was a trade school at the time. You know, they didn't have a degree in paramedicine back then.
Yeah.
They do now. But yeah, so I quit college and, you know, we were moved down here and then I just started working at getting that medic and getting hired. That was my only goal. Like I wanted to get hired and become a medic within 5 years. I think I did it within three, but.
Wow. And what was that continuous relationship after that shooting with your dad? Because I know it was a little bit rocky before, but what was that relationship afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, we're close. I mean, he's an old school cop, you know, like I feel like he really keeps his feelings to himself. We've never really sat down and talked a lot about the shooting. He wrote a book and he's shared some things, but, you know, regarding the shooting and stuff like that, we haven't really talked, but our relationship is wonderful. Good. You know, we spend a lot of time together.
Good. And sometimes it doesn't need to be really relived like you talked about. You know, that's actually bringing up more trauma in the brain, reliving it, those feelings, you know, going through that. Sometimes that can be more traumatic than not. So how was your career, you know, being a young female, now getting into this, you started off with a traumatic experience in the start, you know, you're going into a career that you are exposed repeatedly to traumatic experiences. What was your career like?
You know, back then, my thing was just drive, just push, 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 just go. You know, I had a lot of things I was interested in other than just paramedicine. You know, I liked doing the hazmat stuff. I really was interested in emergency preparedness. You know, I started getting involved in that right away. And I just kept myself super, super busy. I don't think you really realized then what you were doing because, you know, back then, I always joke, but they're like handed you the keys, handed you a radio. You know, you had your FTO for a little bit and it was like, get in the rig, don't kill anybody, you know. And don't really talk about your feelings. You know, you really kept those under the cuff, especially as a female. Mm-hmm. I think because you didn't want to look weak and you always, you know, wanted to look like you were strong, like nothing affected you. So, and I'm pretty emotional. I wear my heart on my sleeve. So sometimes that was hard, but I really just kept very focused in what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And did the shooting come back up at all? I mean, during your career?
It did. The shooting actually, I could smell it. Like, I couldn't even talk about it like I am with you now without getting super emotional for many, many, many years. And I was convinced that that just was normal. I had a counselor that I was seeing, Lisa Johnson, that was constantly telling me, you know, we need to address the shooting. And I was like, the shooting doesn't bother me. You know, if I was stressed, though, I would see the shooter's face. I could hear them. I could see how they pointed the gun. I could still smell it. And so it was very, like, visceral every time I talked about it. Now I can talk about it, and it's like almost like a movie. Like, I was there, but I don't feel it anymore. And I don't have nightmares about it. But for 16 years, I really pushed against getting treated. EMDR scared me. I didn't know what that would do or bring up. And I wasn't really, you know, into doing that. I just thought it was weird. Like, I'm like, I'll come and talk to you, but I don't want to do any of these weird modalities. Right. But my personal life was a mess. Like, my career was awesome. I was pushing through, but I was making some really poor decisions, you know, in my 20s and 30s with just personal things in my life. And so I really wanted to work through what was going on. And so we finally treated the shooting, which made a huge difference. So, you know, I teach first responder resiliency now. And one of the things that I always tell them is do not wait 16 years to get help for something that you don't think is a big deal, because it's really affecting all aspects of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if we say it's not affecting us, how is it affecting our lives? That's what we really should be looking into. You know, are we, insomnia is not, you know, the normal population does not have that.
No.
You know, the normal population does not have these reoccurring dreams or these reoccurring smells. Those are all what triggers are called,
right?
You know, and that is what, even if we do not recognize what is getting remembered, our brain does. It still sits in our brain in those pathways and those neurons and all of that geeky stuff I love, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have learned a lot about that. I think I didn't want to be classified with somebody that had PTSD because it was a disorder, you know, and I didn't want to be labeled with that. I was afraid, you know, the stigma is still very real.
Oh, yeah.
Even now, like, and egos are big, and you just, you're in a very strong, strong community, you know, and the work that you do is tough. So you feel like you always have to be tough. So when it started to be recognized as an injury, then I became a little bit more like, okay, this can be fixed. It can be healed, rather than it's just a disorder that you're going to have to live with. So then I really started working on what kind of modalities can we do to start, you know, making the brain and all of that so it's not looping or whatever, you know. Yeah. I don't know all the words, so it's doing the right thing.
Right. And who was it that told you that switch between, you know, the disorder to an injury?
I believe it was Lisa Johnson. Yeah, I've been working with her for a while. And you know, we were starting to see it come around in, like, workman's comp. It's still, you know, not where we would want it to be. But you started to see people talking more about it as being an injury, not just with first responders, but military and stuff like that. And so then you're like, okay, I can heal from this. Like, a broken leg, you know?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
I can fix this.
Yeah. And I think that statement right there should give our listeners, like, so much hope, is that, you know, it is not a disorder, like, you are going to, you know, die with this, right?
Right.
But it is an injury that you do have to address and you do have to heal from. And every single person's healing process is completely different.
100%.
So what was your healing process?
So, you know, from there, I really felt like I healed and I moved forward and I was doing really well. I actually married a LA County fireman. We're not married now, but I had moved to California and quit for about 4 years and then came back and got right back into the swing of things. But another event, you know, happened. Like, we put the shooting behind us. And then, you know, as my career progressed, you know, I think we see a lot more now than we used to. Things that we weren't necessarily prepared for. And it's just a different world out there than it was when I first started. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things had happened and I had found myself in a position where I was feeling like I was really overwhelmed. I wasn't sleeping. You know, we had some things happen at work. We had lost a coworker to an accident who was married to a coworker who's really good friends of mine. And then I was constantly like trying to do everything. Like I was taking four upper division classes and, you know, I was taking care of my stepdaughter while my husband was gone all the time. He was going back and forth between LA, and I all of a sudden found myself extremely overwhelmed. But I'm never one to ask for help. I'm always the strong one. I'm the oldest of five kids. You know, I'm always the one that everybody comes to. And I don't like to ask for help, nor admit that something's going on. I wasn't sleeping, but I wasn't really recognizing the signals, nor was anybody else really around me, because I was always that strong one. You know, that will never happen to her. And then I, you know, had a moment where I just felt like everything had, I don't know, come to a head, I guess, and found myself in the closet, you know, with a gun to my head. And so that was a turning point for me. Mm-hmm. For one, everything worked the way it needed to that night. I, you know, whatever your beliefs are, I believe God saved me. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's a deep conversation.
Yeah. For a reason, you know, but initially, I didn't want to talk about it. I really wanted to stick my head in the sand and pretend like it didn't happen. I was so afraid that this was going to define me, and I'd worked so hard in my career to get to where I was, and all of a sudden, this was going to be who I was, right? This was going to define me. I actually considered quitting my job. Like, I just didn't really know what to do from there, and luckily, I have an amazing village of people that helped walk me through that. But I still never wanted to tell my story until another first responder on a department committed suicide shortly after my attempt. And I just felt like I was saved, and everything kept me here for a reason, and that I got to be a voice for those that don't have one anymore. And that it was so important to start telling my story and other people to tell their stories, because I think that as first responders, we feel so alone, you know, and we really get, I always tell everybody, don't sit in that silence, because it's deafening, you know, mm-hmm. like your brain just never stops, and it's not your friend at the moment, you know, like you're doing yourself no good if you just isolate and try to internalize everything. It doesn't do any good.
Yeah. The comment of feeling alone is something that I have heard repetitively over people in those situations. What is it about feeling alone? Is it because you don't feel comfortable speaking up? Is it you feel alone because you don't think anybody's going through this? What is that meaning to you?
I think it's a combination of all of that. I think that, you know, for me, I didn't want to tell anybody. You know, I didn't want to tell anybody. I was only sleeping 2 hours a night. You know, the thing I kept saying is, I just need to get through this, right? Mm-hmm. And once I get through that, then everything will be okay. But it wasn't. And it was getting, I was doing nothing well, you know, and I was just getting deeper and deeper into a point where, you know, like the sleeping pills weren't working. And so I was drinking more to try to sleep. And then, you know, you're just like, it's just spiraling. And at that point, you really don't want to admit to anybody that you don't know what to do or where to go, you know, and I don't know if I necessarily knew all the resources at the time that were available. And I was scared to seek them out, even though we had peer support and other things, you know, it's great that we have all that, but still people are very, very scared to speak up and say that they're going through a difficult time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially, like you've said, the culture of first responders is that I am strong. I am, you know, the saving person. Yep. I am that person that people turn to. I am that people pleaser, mm-hmm. right? Like, that is part of the job. Those right. are those masks that you do put on to get a job done. But yet we need to be able to feel comfortable to also take those masks off and say, we're still human at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this is a career, you know, and why I love and I'm so passionate about speaking about it is because this is a career that we know it is a traumatic career. Mm-hmm. And we don't know which call is going to be that one, But we know that you are continuously being exposed to traumatic injuries, right? Like, people aren't trauma for anything, right? Like, we take trauma patients, you know, and what their situation was and what is happening. I mean, those are all things to consider within this job, right? This job is not something where you're like, we go out and we save lives and we are heroes, right?
Well, it's not what it's like on TV.
No.
It's not Chicago Fire.
it really isn't. And so that, I mean, I give you so much just gratitude and grace and blessing that you are here with us today.
Thank you.
And you are here being able to share your story in the hopes of getting it out there.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't know where to turn.
Yeah. I also think a lot of people don't realize that what you do on the day to day is really important. It's something I become very passionate about now because I didn't know before. So it's not just the calls. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like, are you sleeping well? Are you taking care of yourself physically? Do you have mental mindfulness? Like, all that stuff that isn't taught to us that you just don't know about plays such a huge effect, because it's usually not the call that pushes you over the edge. It's the getting rear-ended or something very small happening, but you're not stable, you're not grounded. And so you just, it's that last thing that pushes you over the edge. Yes, the trauma is built up, and especially if you haven't taking care of it, you know, like, you can take those and you can put them away, but they're still there. They still need to be addressed. But it's all the other stuff that you do day to day. You've got to be very intentional to be able to stay healthy in this job.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was your path of actually reaching out and getting that help?
So luckily I got scared because I had unloaded the gun and actually practiced. As a paramedic, I've seen people that have missed, and it scared me. But I had written a note. I had a plan, but I happened to leave the house and go to a restaurant, and I had made a phone call to my ex-husband at the time, and this always gets me. He said it just didn't sound right. And it's funny because we normally would text. We didn't really talk a lot because he was busy or I was busy. But he said he just had that feeling that he needed to pick up the phone. And he's like, you just didn't sound right. Like, what you were saying was off. And he said he had a few choices. You know, it was either not do anything and possibly become a widow, do something and have me be super pissed off because it's your coworkers that are going to come on you, right? And you know the process of what's going to happen. You know, you take people out on calls like this all the time. Or, you know, he's going to call and we're going to get the help in place and it's going to save me. And I thank God every single day that he made that phone call.
Wow. And who did he call?
He called dispatch. He called 911. Yeah. So he also reached out to, you know, my best friend that I was talking about that had lost her husband. And so luckily, you know, I had a couple of supervisors, and her show up, and then, you know, we went through the process of what we would do with the patient, and it was super scary and embarrassing and a lot to walk through, you know. And like I said, I just really wanted to put my head in the sand and be like, I'm fine, it's fine. But I really had to, you know, after I got out of Intermountain and came home and there was a plan in place, and I really knew that, you know, I had to take this serious, and we were really going to need to figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And through the process, I know the process has changed a lot. And most people, I know, right, the process of what this looks like. But talk to us and walk us through what that process was. Getting 911 called, you know, me knowing that you're going to get first responders, you're going to get police, you're going to get EMS out to your house. What was then that happened?
So I actually wasn't home, so they came over to where I was at, and it was my supervisors, you know, one of my best friends, and then an officer, and I, you know, I knew what we were going to walk through, and by then they'd been to my house and had found the gun and found the note, and so, I mean, there was no way I was going to be able to say, you know, I wasn't there, you know, we don't need to do all of this. The process definitely needed to happen. So I was taken to the hospital by the officer, and, you know, there it was, you know, they do the medical clearance and all of that. And I'd had some to drink that night. So, you know, you had to go through all of that. And then I got taken over to Intermountain, where I was on a hold for 72 hours. And that was really hard. You know, I think it's hard as a first responder because there's not a lot of people that you can relate to mm-hmm. there. You know, like everybody's there for different reasons. But it was very difficult for me to try to go through the process and do all the steps because I was like, nobody can relate to what I'm going through. And I don't relate to what, you know, some of the people that I had met were going through. But they were very stern and very like, you know, you're not going to be able to talk your way around this. I think as first responders, we get really good at talking our way around things because we have to talk to so many different kinds of people, right? Mm-hmm. And we wear those masks.
We're really good manipulators.
Yeah. And they called me on the carpet and they were very blunt with me about, you know, the process that I was going to need to do, the work I was going to need to do, and what they were going to need to see and hear before they were going to let me go home and then start the healing process there. Yeah. So that was really hard. And I think the one thing that's scary is that, you know, if I wouldn't have had this tribe of people to help me through it, if you ever got to that point again, you don't ever want to go back there, right? So the scary thing is are you just going to complete it and not tell anybody? Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you get the help you need so that you don't ever end up back in that that position.
Yeah. And what was that getting out? You know, what was that healing process?
So it was round the clock. I called them babysitters for a while, you know, which needed to be. So, I mean, and all of this plan was put into place without my knowledge, with the doctors, you know, my counselors. And so it was really like having someone with you all the time and making sure that you were doing okay. And then it was immediately get in with the counselor. Let's start figuring out what happened. And then one of my really like saving graces was Emergency Responders Health Clinic. Jenna is who I see. And, you know, like I said, I was so embarrassed and I just didn't want to see anybody. I was so scared of what people would think of me. And I remember getting in there. They made my appointment the end of the day. So like nobody was in the waiting room because you run into your coworkers, right? When you go over there. So, and she walked into the room, put her hand on my leg and said, "We love you. And you know, nobody could survive without you. And I'm so glad you're here." And I needed to hear that in the moment. Sorry. And that really made me feel safe. And like it was okay to really start talking about what was going on and being very, very honest with her and with myself, right? So then we started doing labs and all of that. And, you know, a lot of it came down to we figured out why I wasn't sleeping and, you know, all of this other stuff. And some of it was physical and some of it was mental things that I hadn't dealt with, you know, and just feeling overwhelmed and not having boundaries and not being able to say no. And so it's been... It was a process to get to the point where I was ready to go back to work. And again, like I said, I didn't ever want to share my story. I just wanted to go to work and not have anybody talk about it. But, you know, over the last 4 years, I've really focused really hard on that because I think my biggest fear is it happens so fast and without warning that I'm always afraid it's going to happen again. And so if I start to feel anxious or if I start to feel overwhelmed, you know, I've really found a way to fall back on those tools and those people to help me get through that.
What are some of those tools that you use?
So, like I was talking about before, I'm very intentional about, you know, like what I'm eating, making sure I'm getting sleep, you know, and went through this whole sleep process of trying to train your brain to be able to fall asleep and stay asleep without using medication. And I'm happy to say of the last, I think it's been 6 months, I have not had to use any medication. But it takes a while to get there because most first responders use it almost their whole career.
Yeah.
And then I really, like I said, I got passionate about resiliency and had an opportunity to start teaching some classes, which then I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the process of being able to help others not get to the place that I was. And also it helped me heal because I was telling my story, you know, and I was sharing with people. And the amount of comments or people reaching out to you later to tell you that they had been there or like hearing what you had to say made a difference meant the world to me. So you know, I'm super intentional. I journal all the time. I'm very honest with my family. You know, my poor mom, she, I think sometimes, you know, if she can't get a hold of me, it still scares her. And it's been 4 years, you know, like it's hard to see what it did to your friends and family. But I'm just really, really conscious about what I do in my day to day. Am I perfect? No. And it's taken a while to get there. Like the first year afterwards, I was all over the place, you know, like sometimes I do great. Sometimes I was doing awful. It was just, it's been a lot to get to a point where I feel super healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, you know, that mental health really is those intentional tools to use. And everybody's tools can be completely different.
Yes.
You know, and that's why I ask, like, what are your tools? Because what you're doing can be different than somebody else's.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely. So, you know, I love box breathing. It's one thing. I started doing yoga and I really enjoyed that. But I really like box breathing and I love teaching it because it's something you can do very quickly without people noticing you're doing it. But to bring your heart rate down, because, you know, a lot of the anxiety, you start to feel it in your chest, whether it's you going on to a call that's unknown or, you know, something's bothering you at home. It's all the same feeling. It's all the same reaction in your body.
It's all your sympathetic nervous yep. system. You know, that's where it comes down, is to literally, these things are within our bodies to help protect us. But when they get in overdrive mm-hmm. and are continually going, we don't know how to like rein it in.
Right. And I had to learn that it was a physical thing. Like I could not control that anxiety when it got really bad, and that it was okay to rely on other things to help me with that until I learned and got my body back into a really healthy state. You know, when you're living in that drive where you're like really hyped up and then you're down and you're really hyped up, you know, just the calls alone when mm-hmm. you're on duty can have you all over the place emotionally.
Oh yeah. I mean, you're right, 1 second sitting there laughing, having a great time. Now you're out on, you know, a car crash and you got multiple injuries and you got multiple patients and all these things. And, you know, the fight or flight is there to help us. Mm-hmm. And it does help us to focus and to get the job done. However, within that, that it means that our cortisol has spiked. Mm-hmm. That means that our stress responses have, spiked. And these are the things that are happening to help us do our job. But yet we need to help our bodies recover yep. from that.
Yep. And that's where that sleep and exercise and nutrition and, you know, I meditate. Like I said, I journal. That's something I do religiously. You know, I do a lot of manifesting and stuff mm-hmm. like that. You know, it's become a big part of my daily just to help keep me, you know, on track. And when I'm feeling something, instead of feeling like you have to go talk to somebody, sometimes you can just journal it mm-hmm. or write it down, and that helps. Or it helps when you go in and you can't remember what was bothering you, you know, a few days before, and you're like, I journaled exactly what was going on when I was having those feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a little bit about box breathing.
So box breathing is something that you do. So you take a deep breath in and then you hold it, you know, and then you let it back out. So but it's a really deep, like if you do yoga, really deep into your belly. And what it does is it helps calm your system. You know, it brings your heart rate down. It brings that anxiety down. And you literally can just sit there and do it without anybody really noticing that you do it. So when I teach first responder resiliency, like you said, things will work for different people. Some people like to meditate. Some people like to journal. Some people like to do yoga. Some people are like, you're just crazy with all of this. But you hope that you can give them some tools that will work for them, that they'll walk out of there and be like, I kind of like that. You know, I'm going to try that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so interesting because, you know, I've gone to a lot of these conferences. And like at the breaks, they would have yoga and, you know, mm-hmm. you have these firefighters and police officers and like, I am not doing yoga, right? Like,
right.
I am not doing that.
Yeah.
And then they do it because it's available there. And they're right. like, oh, my gosh, this is really wonderful.
Right.
And yeah. it's like, that is mental health.
definitely. And so I think people need to try things. But, mm-hmm. you know, like, again, we have big egos. And so a lot of times we're like, I'm not going to do that, mm-hmm. you know, especially I'm not going to go walk into some yoga class. So if we can teach simple things like box breathing or, you know, first responder yoga is probably what you're talking about from these conferences that are meant to help you mm-hmm. in the station quickly, you know, before you go on a call or as you're driving to the call, you can even do it just to help, you know, calm your nervous system mm-hmm. down.
Yeah. One of the tools that I learned early on was bilateral tapping.
Okay.
So going to a call that I knew we could hear things on the radio, we were getting updates, you know, you try to keep your heart rate down while all of this is happening. And so even just tapping on your legs one side to the other, just really calmly is helping you actually stimulate both sides, mm-hmm. but also calm yourself. And so that was one of the biggest, you know, techniques that I learned. And sometimes I find myself doing it and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm bad at bilateral tapping. Like, yeah. I didn't even realize that I was doing that, but it was to concentrate and to bring that heart rate down.
Yeah.
Like, bring that sympathetic nervous system to a regulated state to be able to continue to do our jobs.
Yeah. I find myself doing box breathing a lot, you know, like, even if you're like frustrated, you're going to have a hard conversation or whatever, you know, that yeah. box breathing really helps. You know, I've never heard of the tapping, but I know, you know, other people that have used that. There's all kinds of things out there yeah. that you can do. It's just a matter of learning what they are.
Mm-hmm. And it's also that self-awareness, right? Because these tools are not new.
Right.
You know, yoga is not new. Breathing is not new, right? We're on this earth to breathe.
Right.
And it's the one thing that continues to, you know, we have to have that to live. And, you know, through all of these things, they're not new. It's just we're getting exposed to mm-hmm. them now. We're finally seeing these things that, oh, wow, this is what mental health is.
Yeah.
You know, mental health doesn't mean that you have an illness or a disorder or, you know, all of these symptoms. It is a resiliency to developing these things.
Absolutely.
Just like you go to the gym and you work mm-hmm. out, trying to avoid diabetes, trying to avoid a heart attack, trying to avoid a stroke. Those are the same things. Now, could it happen? Yes. But are you getting your body into a balanced, mm-hmm. regulated state? Yes, that is what mental health is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that across the nation, though, it's not taught. You know, like when you look it up, you won't find very many people that are teaching this right now. So I think it's something that people need to recognize and really push, mm-hmm. you know, get that out there to your new hires, teach them how to have all of these resources and what to do to be resilient mm-hmm. outside of work, you know, like have other friends, other hobbies outside of your work. I think when you become a first responder, it defines who you are instead of what you do. All of a sudden you are that. I'm Cameo the paramedic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I was so proud of that. But you've got to be able to find other things to help keep that balanced. And I think that's hard to do initially when you first start.
Yeah. It's that identity that you attach with that. And it's still very difficult for myself. You know, and I'm like, what do I say? I'm kind of in it still. I'm, you know, I'm kind of out of it, but I'm prior. And it's like, no, I'm just McKinsey Tiggs.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that is who I am. That was a part of my career, but that doesn't define who you are. That is not your identity.
Right.
Just as a lawyer, that is not their identity.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, for my first responders and for you, you know, being in these situations, to me, I really do believe that that is a barrier we put up.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I'm a first responder and nobody's going to know what I'm going through.
Yep. Yeah. We're very strong. We're who they call. Right. Mm-hmm. So how can you be weak if you're the one that is supposed to be strong all the time? Mm-hmm. And we still very much do that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think also to your point of, you know, this isn't getting taught in the U.S. This isn't getting taught worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, 90 suicides in the world every 40 seconds.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah. If you look up the statistics also, you'll see that there's more suicides than there are in line duty yep. deaths. You know, that's really sad.
Yep.
It shouldn't be happening.
Right. Right. And that's one of my biggest passions of why I want to be able to have people like you and be able to share the story, because that is what is helping normalize that we are all human.
Yeah.
that behind the badge, behind the medication, behind what this job is, you're still a human. Mm-hmm. And these agencies, these, you know, the industry as a whole has done very poorly of that, because they have also kind of enlightened that ego mm-hmm. into them. You know, and I really break it down as like, it's super easy to professionally, you know, grow. You're mm-hmm. going to the next promotion. You're going from, you know, now the, you know, just a regular paramedic to now a supervisor right. to a chief yeah. and all of these things. And that's super easy to grow. But what are you doing personally?
Right.
What are you doing off of shift?
Yep, absolutely.
To help you be good on shift.
Right. Like I said before, you know, when I was doing great in my career, it was because I was hyper focused on it. That's what I was going to spend all my time doing. But I was doing nothing personally to, you know, better myself, to make sure I was balanced, to make sure that when I got to that point, I would be okay, you know, and that's why it's become such a passion to me to be able to share that with people and help people learn that. So again, they don't end up in the closet like I did, you mm-hmm. know, and they don't end up in that position. And if they do, they know who to reach out to and they're not afraid to reach out.
Right. Absolutely. And just, you know, like the podcast, being raw, being real, authentic mm-hmm. and willing to share. And that really comes into the effect of, no matter the amount of resources that we have, if somebody is not able to ask for help, it doesn't matter how many times I ask you, how are you doing?
Yeah.
They're going to lie about it.
Absolutely.
And so it is for the listener, it is for those first responders, that you have to be willing to be vulnerable to get the support.
Yeah. We've got to have a mental shift in our career as first responders. And we really have to be willing to be able to say, I'm not okay. And it's okay to say that. It's not going to define you. It's not going to hurt you. But if you don't address it, you know, either it's going to hurt you in your career, or, I mean, look at all these people that you see after they retire and then they commit suicide. You know, that is heartbreaking that they've gone through all of this and then felt like they couldn't, you know, continue. So it's our job to show people how to do it, but then people have to have that mental mind shift.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What is there that you would want to say to your fellow first responders?
You know, I would love for them to know that you're not alone. You know, like, once you start telling your story, it is amazing how many other people will be like, I've been there, or I've been here, or, you know, what do I do for this? The more we share our stories with each other, the more we're going to be open to not having the stigma, to not being afraid. And also, it's okay not to be okay. You know, you don't have to be the one that's always strong. Mm-hmm. You know, ask for help, tell your story, and, you know, just be there for each other. But also, don't be afraid to ask people if they need help, because, you know, a lot of times we can start to see someone floundering or like something shift, and we're too afraid to ask them if they're okay, or just to be blunt about it. You know, like, are you taking care of yourself? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? What's going on in your home life? Like, if there's someone you're close to, talk to them about it. Don't just sweep it under the rug and be like, they're always strong, they're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's about that, about the happiness too, right? Like, oh, they're always happy, they're good. Those are the people you need to be checking
yeah. on,
because they are the strong ones all the time. They don't have the people coming to them and asking them, how are you doing?
Right.
How can I actually help you? You're always helping me. How can I help you
yeah.
in these situations? And, you know, reach out to your strong friends and reach out to your happy friends, because they're the ones that, honestly, you'll message them and you're like, oh my gosh, this refilled my cup for a whole month, you
yeah.
know? Like, it doesn't take a lot to refill that cup of just gratitude with it.
Yeah, if you have that gut feeling that you need to reach out to somebody, do it.
Yeah.
Because it generally means that that is the universe or whoever, you know, telling you that they need help. Mm-hmm. So if you have that, they're on your mind constantly, reach out to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it can be, you know, that is how we connect.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually how we as humans get to know each other better, open up, support each other, come back to this community
yeah.
aspect, instead of being so divided and judgmental and just kind of, you know, putting ourselves in our own world and saying, well, nobody understands me. It's like, well, you're not allowing people to understand you.
Yeah, we've all got to be open to be able to have those conversations, you know, have coffee with somebody, go to lunch with someone. You know, we used to do that stuff all the time. And now, you know, COVID didn't help, but, you know, now you find that everybody's kind of in their own bubble and doing their own thing. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I haven't talked to somebody for 6 months. You know, I wonder how they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So how are you doing now in your career? How has that shifted?
I am doing really well. I've, you know, I transitioned from out of the field. I work as the emergency preparedness officer now. I really enjoy that job, but it's another stressor, right? Like you're planning big events and you're worried, you know, is everybody going to be safe? How are we going to do this? So you always have a little bit of that element of, you know, fear and stress, whatever you do, I think, as a first responder. But, you know, my other passion has just been, like I said, getting out there and teaching people first responder resiliency. And the more I can get that out there, the more the word can get out, the more people are taking it and taking it to their departments and, you know, really setting up good, solid resources for people and ways that people can talk. Like, whether you have a peer support team or not, you can be that peer, right? Mm-hmm. Be that person that steps out and does something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you coming on, sharing your story, being vulnerable with us, and getting that help to other people, because you sharing your story really is helping those other people be able to hear it, be able to not feel alone. And, you know, thank you for being vulnerable and coming on and sharing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. Listeners, I encourage you to reach out to somebody that is on your heart, is just kind of, you know, they're in your thoughts. If you drive by somewhere and you're like, oh, I haven't talked with them for a long time, reach out to them. Just tell them that you're thinking of them. And I promise you, it'll make their day, right? Yep. That connection, being able to be human again. And I also want to encourage you, if you ever think of committing suicide, the suicide hotline is 988. You can always call 911 as well. But what I want to teach you is to be able to build that resiliency, build that mental health before you get to that point. And, you know, being able to share these stories is helping all of that within our community. So thank you again for coming on to Raw Thoughts.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, guys. I will be back for another episode next week. Talk to you later. Bye. Thank you again for listening to another episode of Raw Thoughts Podcast. I'd appreciate it if you could follow, like, subscribe, and share with anybody that you think would be interested in this. You could also head over to my website at rawthoughtspodcast.com and see any other guests that have been on the episodes. You could also go over to Instagram and follow at rawthoughts.podcast. I would really appreciate it, and always send me a message if you're interested in being a guest or any feedback.